Welcome everyone to the final session of Marxism 2014. Hope you've all had an excellent conference. To cap off our Marxism conference here, we have a session with Shomi, who is a member of the our sister organisation, the ISO, International Socialist Organisation in Aotearoa, which we know maybe more commonly as New Zealand, for anyone who doesn't know the Māori name. And she's on the national committee of that organisation. She's also previously spent time in as part of our organisation here some years ago. And we're very happy to have her giving this session. So,
cool.
Over to you.
Well, first of all, I'd just like to thank everyone for being here, and thank you to Socialist Alternative for giving me the opportunity to speak on this issue. And I'd also like to express warm greetings from ISO and Aotearoa to all the comrades here today. So I'll just get on with the talk of the early Japanese communist woman. So I'll start. What sort of woman are you demonstrating when you should be looking after your children? These were the words that the arresting officer said to Sadayo Nakasone, who was arrested for participating as a woman in the second May Day in 1921. And Nakasone, the female socialist, fired back at the cop, saying, "Well, what sort of man are you? A proletarian who works for the capitalists. Take a look at yourself." You get the sense of the fire that these women had. And Nakasone, the female socialist, along with 20 other socialists on that day, made history in Japan as the first female contingent to march on the second May Day in Japan. They were all arrested for marching under the banner of Sekirankai, or Red Wave in English. And it was an organisation that was established specifically to march in the second May Day in 1921. But that was their specific aim, but they had a wider motivation as well to engage in the struggle to overthrow capitalism and fight for genuine women's liberation. I should say that even though it was 1921 that these women came out as a contingent, women have always been involved in the socialist communist movement from the earliest of days in the early 1900s. But the second May Day, is a continuation of the kind of struggle that had already been happening. I think one of the reasons why the woman decided to come out and march as a contingent in 1921 is probably more symptomatic of the wider political struggle that was happening domestically within Japan, but also internationally. And it was this wider kind of excitement and political climate that pushed women out onto the streets in Tokyo in 1921. The class was on the move, the working class was on the move, revolutionary ferment was in the air, not only in Japan but worldwide, and the Red Wave woman definitely wanted to be part of this. So, and I think the story of the Red Wave woman, I'm really glad Socialist Alternative decided to put on a talk like this, because it has been one that is largely hidden from history. In the most definitive English, they're all English texts that I refer to in this talk, but in the most English, definitive English language history of this period from the Communist Party is this one by George Beckman and Okubo Genji, the Japanese Communist Party, 1922 to 1945, these women do not get mentioned at all. So it rarely took to the 1970s and 80s when Japanese historians and feminists and academics started uncovering a lot of this history that has been hidden. And I'll just mention this one. I don't know if people have come across this, Mikiso Hane's book on reflections on the way to the gallows. This is a really great introduction of a lot of the radical revolutionary women that were alive around this time. And also his other book, Peasants, Rebels and Outcasts, is also a really fantastic read as well for anyone who wants to learn more about the role of women within this particular history. And also Australian academic Vera Mackey has written extensively on this, so just look her up on Google and you'll see the books, that publications that she's written. So what I want to do in this talk is just to give you an introduction of these pioneering women and consider their achievements and also offer some questions about their political legacy. I think their contribution is not known at all in the English-speaking world, and so that's part of what I want to do here, just to give an overview of what their contributions were and to pay tribute to, I suppose, our collective political revolutionary ancestors. Because I want to argue that while they were small, they did achieve something real. Their rebellious presence in the second May Day forced open some space for women to be able to attend subsequent May Days in Japan, and the militants who made up Red Wave, rebellious youth like Magara Sakai, who's this woman here, were part of a worldwide radicalisation in the years following World War I, and their activities flowed into the wider sea of revolutionary organising and activity. So what were the origins of Red Wave? And as I mentioned, Red Wave was primarily established so that women could march as a contingent on the second May Day. There was the Peace Preservation Law, Article 5 of that, which was a law at the time, which absolutely prohibited women from engaging in any political activity of any kind. So women weren't allowed to attend political meetings, they weren't certainly allowed to hold rallies, and they certainly couldn't become members of a political organisation. So it was that Article 5 was absolutely hated. It was, you know, people despised this article that essentially confined women to the home. So the Red Wave, even while it was a female contingent, it wasn't created out of some kind of autonomous organising ideal. It was much more like a practical way of trying to get around this law of Article 5. One of the Red Wave founding members, Fusako Kutsumi, puts it like this. At the time, women could not enter the Socialist League, which was the affiliation that they were loosely associated with, in a satisfactory manner. In order to participate in the Second May Day, we quickly decided to establish a group consisting of women only. So this gives you a sense of it was more like a practical, tactical necessity rather than wanting to organise as women on their own. So what was this Socialist League that Kutsumi is talking about? And I should say all of the women in Red Wave had some loose affiliate or had some, you know, real connection to the Socialist League through their partners or through family members. And it was a broad alliance between anarcho-syndicalists and socialists. At its peak, it had a membership of 1,000, so still, you know, reasonably small. But the League was established out of this desire to establish a revolutionary current against the moderate and larger trade union federation, UIKE, that was around at the time, and they were called a friendly society, which kind of gives you a sense of what kind of trade union they were. They were much more moderate in their aims, and the Socialist League wanted to establish themselves as this distinct revolutionary current, separate to this. Unfortunately, this league was short-lived. An alliance between anarcho-syndicalists and socialists who were increasingly becoming influenced by the ideas of Leninism and Lenin couldn't last forever, obviously. And if anything, the tide of anarchism that was the dominant ideology at the time was beginning to ebb, and much more the ascendancy of the Leninist model of organising, the fact that we need to have a revolutionary party, especially after the successful Russian Revolution in 1917, caused revolutionaries in Japan, socialists in Japan, to seriously reassess what kind of tactical political strategies we need to pursue. So whilst there was this reassessment going on, it's fair to say that they were never very clear about what Leninism and the Leninist model of building a mass revolutionary party was about. Lenin's first work to enter Japan, translated into Japanese, came in 1920, so 3 years afterwards, after the Russian Revolution. And it's fair to say that the leaders of the JSP, the Japan Socialist, not the JSP, the JSA, the Socialist League, sorry, Hitoshi Yamakawa and Toshiyuki Sakai were still very much influenced by anarcho-syndicalist ideas. And a lot of the strategies that they pursued, particularly around universal suffrage, they were opposed to that idea, saying that it was and they were quite ultra-left on this idea, and I think very much influenced by the anarcho-syndicalist ideas. and they kind of denounced anyone who was calling on a campaign for universal suffrage, saying that it was a compromise and it would mislead the working class in Japan at the time. But yeah, and this kind of background, overall background, is important for Red Wave, but I'll get into that a bit more later. So the political situation at the time is quite important to know about as well, because I think that's the most important thing to understand in understanding what pushed Red Wave women to organise out onto the streets. So the end of World War One heralded an economic heralded an end to the economic boom that Japan had enjoyed during the war. And recession hit hard for the workers, and this ignited a worker dissatisfaction and resentment, especially about the gap between the wage prices and price rises. Workers began to fight back in this situation. And just to give you a numerical picture of this, in 1914, so World War One begins, there were just 50 labour disputes that involved 7,904 workers. And 5 years later, in 1919, there was a total of 497 disputes with 63,137 participants. So a phenomenal outbreak of workers' struggle. But, I mean, to contextualise, it is small numbers when we're talking, if we compare it to international statistics, but nonetheless significant for Japan. And this resentment, you can really get a sense of it in Mitsuo Hanae's other book, Peasant Rebels and Outcasts. Sorry, it's not this one, but... The sense of the enormous pressure and oppression of workers, particularly women in textile factories, where, you know, Japan's military might was off the back, and tears and horror that these women experienced in the huge capital accumulation that was going on in Japan at the time. So this resentment broke out after World War One. And I think one of the things that really spooked the ruling class at the time was a riot that happened in Ashio in 1907. That was something that Ashio is quite a remote area in a copper mining town. And there were 3 days of intense rioting where miners used dynamite and arson and destroyed whole sections of the mine. And, you know, at the time it was Japan's most modern mining complex. The government had to go in, declare martial law, and the troops needed to eventually suppress the workers themselves. And also I think the other big international content to this is the Russian Revolution in 1917. This served as enormous inspirations for the socialists to really seriously try and get organised and try and make something of it. Up until then, after Ashio, the state just went on a massive crackdown on all revolutionaries, and it's generally called, there was an incident called the Great Treason Incident in 1911, which involved the state coming up with these, you know, concocted charges against a number of the most prominent revolutionaries at the time, and executing them. So it was... it was called in Japan. It's been called the winter years, where basically nothing much happened during that time. But again, the Russian Revolution in 1917 brought an end to those winter years, and the socialists were willing to throw themselves into activity again. Another important domestic incident that happened around this time was in 1918, when there was a peaceful protest by a woman from a fishing village demanding an end to the high price of rice. And this erupted into nationwide riots. In a couple of weeks, the riots spread throughout the country, and as figures say, upwards of 2 million people were involved in this. And it took the military months to actually shut down the rioters nationwide, and so great was the breakdown of public order at this time that the then Prime Minister had to step down, and Japan at the time appointed its first commoner Prime Minister as a kind of a conciliation to try and, you know, as a carrot to try and quell that mass resentment that had broken out. So these rice riots obviously tapped into a general dissatisfaction of the rural poor, of the urban poor, who were reeling from the long hours of slave-like conditions, which was a product of the breakneck industrialisation, capital accumulation and militarisation that was going on in Japan at the time. So all of this political context was further evidence for the socialists that there was increasing class consciousness. Magara Sakai, the revolutionary here, she says of this time, given this momentum, she's also one of the founders and core leaders of Red Wave, she said it was only natural that women were going to be spurred into activity. There was obviously an urgency that was propelling socialist women into getting active, and Magara was deeply affected by socialist slogans like there is no true liberation without female emancipation, and women are the last slaves. And what she took from these slogans was that it was the lack of female participation in these revolutionary movements that was actually holding the process of revolution back. So I'd say it was perhaps a bit voluntarist, but, you know, it was her sentiment, I've got to get in there, I've got to get start organising, I've got to start getting active. So what were Red Wave's aims and ambitions at this time? So, like I said, marching on May Day was their most immediate reason for establishing Red Wave, but these women had other greater aims as well. And Magara wrote the simple founding statement. It's just two sentences long. We are opposed to the tyranny that has made our brothers and sisters ignorant and impoverished, which has bound them to slavery and a life of obscurity. We stand in firm opposition to such oppression. But it's fairly simple. But I think what's evident here in these two sentences is her attempt to delineate or separate Red Wave from the dominant feminist thought that was around at the time. She's trying to make clear that it's not feminism but socialism which is at the heart of the group's politics. And I think her references to brothers and sisters in a common fight against slavery and a life of obscurity is indicative of this. And again, we stand in firm opposition indicates that she saw women and men as comrades against a common enemy, which was the capitalist class. And moreover, that she wants to stress that it was the system itself that was at the heart of the oppression. And Kikue Yamakawa, who is this woman here, also another founding member of Red Wave, she makes this kind of delineation more explicit in the manifesto that Red Wave wrote, but I'll go into that later. So while their aims were set high, they wanted to overthrow the system, they were actually quite humble and realised they had a realistic image of themselves. The term Red Wave is not a literal translation. I'm a translator, so I get quite finicky about these things. That's for any Japanese students. Seki Rankai, the Red Wave Society. But this term here, wave, it's more like a ripple. So it's actually the literal translation would be Red Ripple Society. That's the kind of impact that these women hope to have on Japanese society, a small ripple. So, you know, there was a humility to, I suppose, their understanding of the limitations and the potential impact that these women could have, which was, yeah. So I want to go into a political profile of Kikue Yamakawa, who was one of the women that I pointed out earlier. And she also authored the Red Waves manifesto. So that's Kikuya here. She was highly intellectual, and she came from a relatively affluent samurai family. So her relative privilege enabled her to continue on her education until high school, and it was something both her parents really encouraged in her to follow her academic pursuits. And as a socialist writer, and she really, before she joined Red Wave, she really cuts her political teeth debating Seto, the Blue Stocking group, a liberal and bourgeois feminist grouping at the time. She was highly critical of the group and their calls for women's suffrage. So that, again, you can see the influence of anarcho-syndicalism there. In one polemic, she criticised the bourgeois feminists for their philanthropist nature toward the toward working women. And she writes, "We believe that there are absolutely no methods within a capitalist society which are capable of alleviating the misery of female workers. We believe that it is a sin to squander the strength of weak women workers in the movement to improve working conditions and in the profitless, labour-consuming diet movement," diet being the parliament, "that is any movement which diverges from the only road to salvation for women workers, the destruction of capitalism. But bourgeois gentlewomen, because they cannot trust or imagine a society beyond capitalism, concentrate their energies on ineffective attempts to alleviate the misery of working women." And again, I mean, I think, like I said, this reflects her ultra-leftism, and it's impacted by the anarcho-syndicalist ideas, which were the dominant ideas at the time for socialists. But I think, I don't want to make a political gloss over it, but for Kikuya, I mean, her reading of the political times was that revolution was a real and present possibility. Revolution was really on the cards. So she felt that any move towards trying to legitimise parliament and the parliamentary process would actually unnecessarily blind workers into a compromise with the system rather than its overthrow. So, again, I don't want to gloss over, I think it was a political era, but, that was, I think, part of their justification at the time. And it's clear that her own views on this changed later. She acknowledged the ultra-leftism, particularly after the Russian Revolution. She made a political break, or attempted to, whilst being still quite heavily influenced by anarcho-syndicalism, and moved towards Bolshevism. And with this move came a more nuanced view, I'd say, of the importance of winning the right to vote and of female participation in that electoral system. Kikuya, I should say, though, played quite a peculiar role within Red Wave. She was enlisted more as an advisor, so not as an activist, but as an advisor to the society. She didn't necessarily march on the day, on May Day, but she lent her support in penning the manifesto and speaking at public lectures, fundraising, working bees, so on. So in other words, while she was a peripheral member, she gave the group some focus through her writing. And I'm going to quote the manifesto that Kikuya penned in its entirety, partly because it's the only remaining document that Red Wave actually commissioned. But also it shows, I think, the politics that cut against the essentialism that was employed by bourgeois feminists at the time. She really makes explicit the link between capitalism, imperialism, and women's oppression in the manifesto. So she writes, "May Day is the proletariat's day, the day for us oppressed workers. Women and workers have travelled the same road of ignorance and oppression for countless centuries, but dawn is about to break. The dawn bell first sounded in Russia, moment by moment dispels the dark gloom of capitalism and tells of approaching victory. Together with our brothers, let us ring the bell with all our strength to signal the liberation of the proletariat in Japan. Women, you have awakened. Join in May Day." So now this is me. So it's clear from this first sentence that the Russian Revolution, you know, has this momentous inspirational effect on these women. And, you know, this is the main impetus that they're trying to encourage women out onto the streets. The manifesto continues, "The Red Wave Society is a women's..." "The Red Wave Society is a women's organisation that plans to participate in the enterprise to destroy the capitalist society and build a socialist society. The capitalist society turns us into slaves at home and oppresses us as wage slaves outside the home. This is a society which has driven many of our sisters into prostitution and, for the sake of its own aggressive ambitions, has taken away our beloved fathers, lovers, children, and brothers. A society which, for the sake of its own greedy profiteers, greets the proletariat of other countries with artillery and slaughter. So I think in this paragraph, this is me again, it's clear that Kikuyu stresses the oppression of women within capitalism. She's saying it's rooted within capitalism, and so it's the system itself that needs to be destroyed for socialist society to build for genuine women's liberation. And I think the manifesto is at pains to point out the savagery and the barbarism of capitalism, and it's pushing a clear anti-war, anti-imperialist stance here as well, which is quite notable because it was one of the only women's organisations at the time to take an anti-imperialist stance against Japan's imperial incursions into Korea and into China. So the manifesto ends with a rousing call again for women to come out onto the streets on May Day. She finishes, "The Red Wave Society declares all-out war on the cruel, shameless society. Women who wish to be liberated join the Red Wave Society. Socialism offers the only way to save humankind from the oppressions and abuses of capitalism. Sisters who love justice and humanity join the socialist movement." So you get a sense of the kind of, you know, ambitions and hopes that these women had. And sadly for Kikuyu, she couldn't participate on the May Day, partly because her son was on the verge of death, suffering from diphtheria, and she herself had just recently recovered from tuberculosis, which was a disease that was very killed a lot of revolutionaries around that time as well. So we'll kind of skip over. I did want to do one of Sakai Magara as well, but we'll get a bit more into her later, I suppose. So we'll kind of go into the actual day. How did the actual intervention into May Day work out for them? So by all accounts, according to the bourgeois press, the following day, it was an astounding success. So far from this ripple effect that they just hoped to achieve, it was more like a tsunami. And while there are only 20 women who marched on the day, the absolute savagery and vitriol attacks that these women faced in the press the next day was astounding. And the particular fury was directed at Magara, Sakai Magara here, who was just 19 at the time, a recent graduate of a women's college. the Red Wave woman successfully managed to march with 10,000 other workers to mark the second May Day in Tokyo. And this May Day was twice as big as the first May Day in 1921. For the day, the members took precaution of just gathering in ones and twos on an upstairs of a barber who was sympathetic to what they were doing, and to march halfway through, to join the march halfway through. They took this precaution because they didn't want to be arrested before the march had even started. And they met in their ones and twos so that the police wouldn't stop them en route to joining the march. And they had two hand-sewn banners for the day. Their main banner with the kanji Seki Rankai, which is that, and it's which we have no remaining banner of, but a smaller banner as well with the letters RW. So this is one of the only remaining banner. The woman couldn't ask for a better day. It was a perfect, gorgeous May Day. There's not a single cloud in the sky. And as the May Day procession edged closer, the Red Wave woman rushed towards the march and joined the Radical Printing Union, which, Kay, you could probably talk more about. And Magara recalls this moment of when they rushed in to join this march. We were met with huge applause by the unionists, and the march welcomed and surrounded us. There was tremendous support from passers-by, and supporters bring us sweet bread rolls and water to drink en route. Mm-hmm. People were waving at us from trams and tapping their windows from above to show their support. Mm-hmm. So you can just imagine the sense of solidarity, the defiance and the strength that these women felt for attending their very first mass march for the very first time. You know, if people know this feeling, for anyone who marched, you know, on the march, that feeling of collective anger and solidarity, that's, you know, immense sense of empowerment. And Margaret is still to this 60 years later in the memoirs, still talked about this day being one of her political highlights. And surprisingly for the woman, police let them march. So they, you know, were able to show their flagrant defiance of the peace preservation law, but they were all arrested at the end. Half the woman had to spend a night in custody as well. So here's some pictures of some photos that made it to the bourgeois press and the next day, with captions like outrage, you know, woman protesting, shock, horror, that kind of thing. That's Sakai there. And the other two, I think that's Fasone, and that is, I'm not quite sure.
I think it's the first picture you showed us, isn't it? The lady that said, you said that she wasn't socialist or communist, but she was more activist.
Oh, no, Yamaka Kikue wasn't there, yeah. And this is the reflection on the way to the gallows. So this is another one of the woman who was arrested there as well. So, yeah, so these were all photos from the press the next day. the first few lectures, activities that Red Wave had to organise after this arrest was to fundraise for themselves to pay for the fines. For distributing unauthorised, the manifesto that I read out earlier, asking women to join May Day. So these lectures, police intimidated and harassed anyone who was seen to try to enter these lectures. By everyone who attended these fundraising lectures had to give their name, their occupation, their work or their school as they entered the lecture hall. And, of course, you can imagine in this kind of political repressive time, students and workers faced being fired or expulsion if you're a student for even associating themselves with a meeting like this. But one of the highlights of the fundraiser was, of course, the 19-year-old Magara, who made her political speech at this event. And to the crowd, she, you know, recounted her experience. And the police at the time called her baby cheeks. What are you doing on this protest? To which she responded, "What do you want, Porky?" the officer at the time was so momentarily stunned that he readdressed her saying, "Oh, madam, sorry, you know." To which Magara then responded to the fundraising crowd, "Comrades, I'd like to clarify that I'd prefer to be called baby cheeks than madam." Madam means a woman who does not work, sponges off the labour of others, and dresses herself up to pursue her dream of marriage. I have no desire whatsoever to get married, and even if I work, that doesn't mean I'm truly independent or liberated. So this is a far cry from the good wife, wise mother, Japanese state propaganda of the time, obviously. Which largely confirmed, you know, good wife, wise mother, confirmed women's roles to be in the home. And I should also say that the state propaganda only ever applied to middle class women. Peasant and working class women were obviously expected to work and work and work. But again, I think similar to the manifesto that Kikue penned, it shows Magara's attempts to delineate and separate her socialist politics from the dominant bourgeois feminist politics at the time by talking about the class division within women. So I'll move on to my... Okay. the aftermath of Red Wave. So while I do want to leave it at this high point, the reality is that Red Wave disbanded within 6 months. It didn't even last a year. And only ever managed to have a membership of about 40 or so. The leading members were either run out of town or arrested. And Magara herself, with several other members, were arrested and jailed for distributing anti-militarist leaflets to soldiers themselves in November. She was working then for the Enlightened People's Communist Party, which was a predecessor to the official Japanese Communist Party. Magara was then sentenced to 4 months imprisonment And I should say she was only the third woman ever in Japan to be charged for thought crimes, along with Fukuda Eiko and Kanno Suga, who were revolutionaries executed earlier. And if people want to read more about those revolutionaries, Mikiso Hane has got an excellent introduction in this book as well. But in some ways, the revolutionaries who were arrested around this time, Magara Sakai being one of them, but also her father, they were actually quite lucky to be in the cells at this time. In Japan, there was the Great Kanto Earthquake in 1923, and some 100,000 people's lives were lost. It was a 7.9 magnitude earthquake, if it wasn't initially the earthquake that killed people, and then it wasn't necessarily the fire that broke out that killed people, then it was the authorities' rampage. They went around and murdered a whole lot of revolutionaries, including Ito Noe, who was one of the founding members, Ito Noe here, an anarchist and her lover at the time, along with thousands of ethnic Koreans who were in Tokyo at the time. So, in a strange twist of fate, Magara escaped that. The Yamakawa family had gone into hiding, so they were all right, but many other trade unions were not so lucky. So it was this kind of repression, I think, that was the immediate cause of the demise of Red Wave, but it wasn't the only cause. And I think the biggest factor of the collapse was the disbandment of the Socialist League, the wider political organisation that Red Wave was affiliated to. There was at the time in Japanese, Anaboru Bensō. It was an anarchist Bolshevik debate, and the debates really kind of came to a head within this organisation, and it split apart on this basis. And with the influence of the Russian Revolution, it was the socialists that was beginning to understand that anarcho-syndicalism was actually something very, very different from communism. And this new understanding resulted in Yamakawa Hitoshi, who is Kikue's partner, founding, and he was also, you know, her along with Yamakawa Hitoshi and Kikue were one of the founding members of the Japanese Communist Party. And one of the big documents from this time was penned by Kikue's partner. He wrote a pamphlet called The Change of Direction of the Proletarian Class, which was for the first time an explicit attack on anarchism and arguing for the need to create a genuine revolutionary party. And this was obviously influenced by the Comintern as well, who were wanting to create, you know, revolutionary parties in East Asia. But I think it's also important to note the wider class struggle dynamics at the time as well. The decreasing influence of anarchism was also a product of this. Workers needed and were searching for some kind of coherent theory and political course of action. And early on, from 1907 with the Ushio riots, spontaneous workers' action met the emotional needs of a labour movement. They wanted to lash out, and they wanted to, break out from the oppressive social and political system. But with the post-war recession and the backlash, the huge suppression from the government, workers needed something more than blind militancy. They were looking for political solutions. And back to Red Wave, Red Wave was also beginning to show these political cracks as well, similar to the Socialist League, between anarchists and socialists. So I suppose in the concluding comments, unfortunately, Red Wave left no tangible legacy in terms of publications, and neither were they established long enough to, call themselves a genuine organisation with real roots in workplaces or social campaigns. Obviously, they were only ever 40 members big. But I think it would be misleading to say that they left no legacy. Socialist women and feminists had a partial victory in 1922 when that Article 5 that, basically said women are not prohibited from partaking in political activity was partially amended to allow a woman to attend political meetings, although they still weren't allowed to become members of any political meetings, political organisations. And subsequent May Days have had a contingent of women attending the marches. So that's until they were banned altogether. But that was one kind of positive legacy that they left immediately. And, of course, the other thing that I haven't, you know, had a chance to touch on was, of course, Magara and Kikue, along with a few of the other Red Wave members, went on to become involved in the first underground Japanese Communist Party that was established in 1922, which was a response to the Communist International, you know, saying it's necessary to build revolutionary parties. But I'll let Magara have the last word on what her appraisal of this, these, you know, quite wild 6 months for her in a memoir she wrote 6 years later. So she says, looking back on it, I neither regret nor am ashamed of my socialist politics. Red Wave was not able to achieve much in the short space of its existence. We were inexperienced and there were undoubtedly points that we deserved to be criticised on. But we owe it to ourselves to give ourselves a pat on the back for standing up together despite our poor and destitute circumstances and for facing up to the most unbelievable persecution and contempt and for leaving behind this legacy. And I'll leave it there.